Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, I'm joined by Helen Rosner, the executive digital editor at Sever.com, the digital home of the lovely print magazine Sever that we all love and know very, very well. And Helen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Super excited to be here, other Helen.
This is the first time there has ever been another Helen on this show. And more importantly, you are quite young, which as a Helen, you know, is a rare thing.
It is not a name given to the young very often. I think, you know, when you hit 75, they'll rename you Helen if you hadn't previously had that name. But no, for someone like you or me who has more non-gray hair than gray, it's a very rare phenomenon.
It's shocking, and it's a real great party trick, let me tell you. But God bless our grandmothers, or maybe not your grandmother.
Great-grandmother.
Oh, hey.
Yeah,
all right.
Even older.
So, tell me this. How did you get your start in food?
Wow. I got my start in food a little bit in a roundabout way. Everybody, I think, is into food. It's always funny when people say, oh, I've always been into food. Well, you know, you have to be. Otherwise, you will probably not last too long.
You'll die.
you will die at the age of four. But, when I was in college, I studied philosophy with a focus on mathematical logic because I was a big, big old nerd. And for one of my natural language processing courses, I did a little bit of a dissection of recipes as a form of technical writing. And I got really into them, and I suddenly had this sort of epiphany moment when I realized that recipes were really cool as a way of communicating a certain amount of information. You know, it's a well-written recipe is like the author giving computational instructions to whoever's following the recipe. If you write them correctly, you might as well be giving, you know, punch cards into a robot, and you're going to get exactly the correct result, and there's a right and a wrong way to write a recipe. So I got really into that, and that sort of naturally led into getting into cooking from the recipes, though I spent a good couple of years reading recipes without actually cooking from them. And it wasn't until I moved to New York after college and started actually cooking that I realized I was into not just recipes, but food as a whole, as something that was really culturally interesting and something that was a way of telling stories about who you were or where you were or, you know, evoking other times and other places. And from that, I wound up getting a job as a book editor, working as an assistant to the director of cookbook publishing at Workman, the legendary Suzanne Rafer, who has produced books like The Silver Palette Cookbook. I mean, she's brought some incredible, incredible titles out into the world. And I worked as an assistant cookbook editor for a couple of years, and the pace of book editing is a little bit lethargic. It takes about 18 months to get any sort of payoff for your work. And I was getting a little tired, and I wanted a little bit more immediate gratification, so I switched to the absolutely opposite end of the spectrum and started blogging for New York Magazine about restaurants in Chicago, writing, 10 or 15 posts a day for Grub Street Chicago, which I was the founding editor of, which I was writing, for the record, while living in New York, which was
wow,
strange but delightful.
Impressive.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. It was like writing about Narnia. I mean, it was stuff that was happening in another place, but restaurants are restaurants, and news is news. And after a couple of years doing that, I started writing for Grub Street New York and became an editor there, and came over to Sever, which was a kind of logical progression.
In the beginning of your explanation,
yeah,
it started to make me realize that my family, we are all very terrible at math, and they're really terrible at making recipes. So I think there's like some sort of correlation there. But
you're totally right. I think you're absolutely right. Recipes are secretly math. You know, food is cooking. Cooking is science, as has been very explicitly laid out in books like Modernist Cuisine. But, you know, as soon as you turn on a stove or as soon as you mix any two things together to create a slightly tweaked combined flavor, you are dealing with totally basic chemistry and physics.
So, two things. What are some of your favorite cookbooks of all time? And then secondly, what cookbooks should people be checking out right now that are new cookbooks that you're excited about?
All-time favorite cookbooks, that's always hard. I have, you know, I think like a lot of people who have a job like mine, I have probably close to 1,000 cookbooks at home, in part because I have a horrible addiction to buying them all the time, and in part because one of the very lovely perks of being a professional food editor is they just send them to you in the mail. And it's very hard to say no. But I think of all time, some of my most loved and most important cookbooks, the one that I cook out of the most frequently, that I actually open and make the recipes from, is one of the America's Test Kitchen cookbooks, the new Best Recipe, though I actually have the original edition, which is just called the Best Recipe. And that is also, I think, the answer to your second question about what cookbooks should everyone be checking out. This is just such an essential foundational cookbook. It basically has the master recipe for anything you could imagine making. It's the roast chicken, the macaroni and cheese, the chocolate chip cookie. And as fans of America's Test Kitchen would know, they also provide really incredible explanations of why this works. And that sort of speaks to what I was saying about how food is science. I think they present that in a very accessible way. They don't kind of hit you over the head with the fact that you're getting a chemistry lesson, but they will explain that, you know, this particular proportion of baking soda to flour in the chocolate chip cookie produces such and such a texture. And if you want to have a slightly chewier texture, if you want to have a slightly denser texture, you can just modify the baking soda just a little bit. So for me, this cookbook is the ultimate universal springboard. I think there's almost nothing you could make that it won't have something to say about. And then for me, I'm a big improvisational cook. I do a lot of, you know, reading a whole bunch of recipes and synthesizing them together. Some of them are from the internet, some of them are from cookbooks, some of them are from magazines. Sometimes I just make things up. But having that foundation really helps whatever I'm making not turn out terribly. If I understand the basic philosophy behind, you know, the chicken fricassee or the, you know, eggplant roulade, then I can go crazy and make it my own. So that's one of my favorites. And I think the other kind of all-time favorite cookbook for me is the French Laundry cookbook, which is really on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of accessibility. It's not a cookbook that's written for the sort of weeknight cook. It's a very painstaking, very, very beautiful, very precise recreation of the dishes that were being created at the French Laundry at the time that the book was published, which is, I think, 2004, 2005. And it's definitely tweezer food. It's definitely not the kind of thing you make unless you have a real unlimited budget and ambitious dinner party plan and probably a paid cleaning crew. But, you know, in the same way that I think the Best Recipe gives you a roadmap to make any dish that you want to make, this is sort of seeing what can happen when the dish is made absolutely to the best way possible with the fullest culinary philosophy and the most extraordinary ingredients. And, you know, if you take one that's on one side of the spectrum and the other that's on the other, and you read both of them and you take both of them in, you sort of synthesize them, your cooking will wind up sort of perfectly in the middle and have that very smart, very technically precise, very beautiful soul built on a foundation of solid culinary technique.
I think about, like, you know, in when discussing what makes a good recipe, I mean, beyond the accuracy of measuring stuff, you know, Sauveur's Test Kitchen is one of the most amazing test kitchens in the world.
Well, you used to work there.
Yes, but that's not why it was amazing. But that's completely unrelated. But, you know, you think about, you know, your process and you're not in the test kitchen, but Sauveur has a process. Mm-hmm. Places like Food 52, you know, in terms of the way in which recipes are edited by a community base online there. We're in this era where we have different ways of accessing a recipe, if that makes sense. So beyond measurements, what makes a good recipe?
Well, I think a recipe has to be conceptually simple. That doesn't mean it has to be easy to do once you're in your kitchen, but there, there should be something that's just immediately apparent to you as a cook that is what this recipe is. And whether that's a combination of flavors, you know, if it's going to be a cupcake or, you know, a frittata or something, if you're going to say, okay, this is a ramp and goat cheese frittata, you understand immediately what's going on. The concept is really easy, and it could wind up being a crazy egg souffle that involves, you know, a million steps and a really crazy expensive French whisk, but the concept is there. Or it could be that the technique is conceptually simple, even if the ingredients are not part of it. So it could be something that's a gratin or something that's a, you know, again, a souffle is something that's a concept that we're familiar with. So I think for a recipe to be successful in the sense that a lot of people want to make it and you're going to see it get like shared 400,000 times on Pinterest, it's got to be something that people can very easily wrap their brains around. That's what gets us exciting. I mean, excited. Cooking and eating are these visceral physical activities. I mean, your mouth waters when you think about something. And that's an instantaneous and involuntary reaction. So, you know, I think the best recipes are the ones that kind of bypass our conscious brains and go straight to that hunger and straight to that desire. I mean, that's what makes you print out the recipe or dog ear the page in the cookbook or pin it to your Pinterest board. And those are the things that you don't have to think about too hard. They speak in a language you already know.
Food porn.
Food porn. Totally. Food porn. Yep.
So on Sevre.com right now, you have the best food blog contest happening.
Yes. It's the fourth year of the Sevre Best Food Blog Awards, in which we open up to a vote our selection of the very, very best food blogs in the world, not just in America, in the entire world, across a dozen categories. So we have, I think it's 70 individual blogs that are recognized this year across these categories, and they are freaking spectacular. Honestly, food blogs, there are so many of them, so many of them. We have open nominations for these awards, and last year, we haven't finished counting them for this year, but last year we received, across the 17 categories that we had last year, almost 40,000 individual nominations for these blogs. And one of the things that we do in the course of selecting who the finalists are, because a panel of Sevre editors kind of goes through all the nominees and selects the finalists for them, we look at every single one of these blogs. Every single one. And this is a multi-week process, and everybody gets a little bit brain dead. But you look at thousands upon thousands of food blogs, and you really see how much is out there, and how much that's out there is extraordinary. Like, not just, you know, Smitten Kitchen, which I think is everyone's sort of go-to and is a wonderful food blog, but there is such diversity of voice and so much extraordinary visual presentation and people who have such unique and interesting approaches to food. It's incredibly invigorating. I think, you know, food is such a universal that it takes work to keep it feeling fresh all the time. And it's so enthusiasm inspiring. I mean, it just lights such a fire under you to see how many, literally thousands of people are able to make it continue to seem fresh.
Good God. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of entries.
It's a lot of WordPress, man.
How long is this contest going on for?
The last day to vote is tomorrow.
Okay.
You can cast a vote at sevre.com/blogawards, and we will be announcing the winners on Tuesday.
And what happens to the winners? Do they go to Disneyland?
They go to Vegas.
Oh,
for serious. Really? This year, the Blog Awards, this is the fourth year of the Blog Awards. And the first year, like all great things, I think it started very small. So in the first year, it was this very sort of low key, like there was a page on the website, everything was cool, nobody really, like people were into it, but it wasn't like a thing. And the following year, it got a little bit bigger. Last year, we threw the first ever Blog Awards party, which was in the Sevre Test Kitchen, which is an incredibly beautiful, super fun space to throw a party in. And we had about 150 people. Some of our finalists and winners flew in from Texas and California. Someone came in from the UK. It was really exciting. It was a lot of bloggers, a lot of editors, a lot of writers, a lot of really incredible food. And the really incredible food happened to come from a chef who's been a great friend of Sevre, who is at one of the restaurants at the Bellagio in Las Vegas. And he had such a great time with us that Bellagio offered to host our party this year instead of having it in the Sevre Test Kitchen. So we're all going to Vegas in May, and the winners of the Best Food Blog Awards, the winner in each category, is getting flown out for the party.
Oh my God.
Like, major oh my God.
Get your glitter ready. That sounds so fun.
It's going to be pretty off the hook.
Well, we are going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, lots more from Helen Rosner of Savur.com. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Joe, your computer is so slow, I can't even use this thing.
Yeah, I should probably get a new one. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, totally, man. You should go to TechServe.
Okay, what's so good about TechServe?
Well, they've got this awesome new insider program that's free when you get a new Mac with AppleCare. So you should buy your computer there because you get 50% off data transfer, free loaner computers, front-of-the-line repair privileges, an annual Mac tune-up service, backup consultation and setup, seminars, and much more.
Okay, yeah, where's TechServe?
It's at 119 West 23rd Street in New York City. They're New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, and you should totally check out TechServe.com for more information.
All right, that settles it. I'm headed to TechServe.
Did you know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization? If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by another Helen who is a young, sprightly gal from Savur Magazine, Helen Rosner.
Hello.
And before the break, we were talking about a real shocker topic on Heritage Radio. We were talking about food, and I know it's a new territory here, but I'd love to talk about Savur's Tumblr presence, because you guys have an amazing Tumblr site.
It's
beautiful. Tell me more.
Well, it's at Savur, S-A-V-E-U-R, the French spelling, .tumblr.com, and it's food porn. I don't know. It's, you know, one of the best things about Savur, one of the things that got me so into the magazine years before I ever started working there, was the photography. If you've ever picked up a copy of Savur, if you've ever visited Savur.com, you know how incredibly immersive and extraordinarily unlike any other food photography out there the images in the magazine are. And, you know, we have a lot of online presences. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Pinterest, but none of them is quite so committed to making our beautiful pictures look super, super beautiful as Tumblr is. So we were really, really, really thrilled to start a Savur Tumblr, which we only kicked off a couple months ago, but it's gone really well. A bunch of our followers are very, very active, and we love them. But yeah, we post on the Savur Tumblr probably 5 or 6 times a day, and it's a pretty random selection of recipes and photos that we are excited by at that moment. You know, our Facebook page is a pretty chronological update of what's appearing on Savur.com. Same goes for our Twitter account. Same goes for Pinterest. But Tumblr is really just what we're feeling at any given moment, whether it's, you know, a totally beautiful close-up of a Neapolitan pizza, or buffalo wings or a bunch of cocktails. You know, we are just like, what looks good? What has us feeling hungry? What are we craving? We just throw it up there.
You look hungry. What more do you want?
Yeah, you can relate to that, I'm sure.
Bad jokes today. Real bad jokes.
They're good jokes.
So, you know, you guys have some other interesting things going on the website. You've got great videos, which I was creeping on pretty hard this afternoon.
Aren't they awesome?
They're beautiful.
They're so fantastic. Beautiful. And they've been winning a lot of awards, which we are, you know, we're not doing it for the awards, obviously. I mean, it's an honor just to be nominated. But no, our executive food editor, Todd Coleman, who is probably the single most talented man on the planet, as far as I can tell, shoots almost all of the photography for Sever, oversees all of our recipe and food coverage, and then kind of out of nowhere, about a year ago, was like, hey, I'm going to just try my hand at filmmaking, and just started producing the most exquisitely beautiful videos that you've ever seen in your life. These are, I mean, if you go to sever.com/video, you can see all of them there, and they're beautifully framed, beautifully composed, sort of moodily lit videos that they're kind of how-to, but they're more like these beautiful narrative stories about how people relate to the dishes that they cook. So each one features one person making something and sort of talking us through their relationship to this food, how they learned how to make it, what these ingredients are doing, what it says about them and their personal history or their culture. You know, we've had, you know, women from Central America come in and make a fish stew. We had Martin Yan come in and make scallion pancakes. I mean, it's really all over the map, and they're beautiful, and they have this like beautiful music. There's this one that we put up about a month ago that's these gorgeous Southeast Asian sort of cardamom syrup soaked donuts called gulab jamun. And that video, I'm not joking, made me cry the first time I saw it. The music and the imagery and the story that this woman was telling about how her mother used to make these donuts for her. I was sitting at my computer at work, this 90-second video with tears streaming down my face. I mean, they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. And they make you want to eat all of the food.
Yes, absolutely. There's one video very near and dear to my heart, which is the inside Brennan's during service. It's a great kind of quick snapshot of like exactly what goes on in that kitchen, and it's amazing. So I'd love to know, you know, you guys have other components. You've got an amazing thing called Recipe Comics.
I love Recipe Comics.
What's going on there?
Recipe Comics, you know, if you were listening in on the first half of our conversation, you would have learned that I am a huge nerd. And my nerd extends beyond mathematical logic and encompasses comics. I'm a big, specifically web comics nerd. I read a lot of comic strips on the internet. I'm very proud of this fact. I like who I am. But so I one day a couple years ago, Recipe Comics is you know, we're a big team at Sever, and everybody does a lot of wonderful things, and I work with some really extraordinary folks on the digital side, but Recipe Comics is really my baby. And it came about because I read all of these web comics and I loved all of them, and I wanted an excuse to become friends with their creators. So I decided, what if I just reach out to all of the people who make these, you know, 2 or 3 dozen webcomics that I read on a religious basis? I have an entire RSS reader set up just for my comics. And I ask them to draw recipes for me. And then we'll email, and then we'll become friends. And then, like, we'll have sleepovers and braid each other's hair. And then maybe I can be a character in all of their comics. And they'll mention me on Twitter. And everything will become amazing. And that's kind of what happened. I have not actually had my hair braided by any of these folks yet. But I reached out to a couple of dozen comic artists, and the brief that I sent them was one sentence. It was, draw a recipe, keep it PG-13, and make it run vertically instead of horizontally. And they responded in droves, and we've run several dozen really phenomenal recipe comics that have an incredible array of styles. There are some very kind of comically formal ones that are panel comics with characters talking and speech bubbles, and there are some that are very kind of experimental visually that might kind of cross the line more into what you might consider graphic design or display art or fine art, and some that are very kind of moody and like emotional and weird and dark, and some that are very poppy and have, you know, talking animals. And it's a really great way, I think, as it evolved, it really kind of started taking on a life of its own. It's a really great way of thinking about food and thinking about recipes in a way that we don't always think about food and recipes. You know, recipes are written in, you know, black type on white paper, and you're supposed to take them into the kitchen and cook from them. And the thing that's supposed to be inspiring and exciting and sort of sensual and sensorily evocative is the finished dish. And what we're doing with recipe comics is making the actual recipe itself kind of the end goal, which is fun.
Which I dig, because I feel like when I cook from certain cookbooks, the book itself turns out looking like that. Who is it from the Goonies, the guy in the basement? Like, the book is just destroyed, like a table, and, you know, you probably wouldn't want to eat my food because you're like, your kitchen's a disaster.
But I don't know. I think that's the mark of a good cook, honestly. I mean, folks who are too precious with their cookbooks are not going to put enough passion into their cooking.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are certain cookbooks that you put behind, like, plastic and, you know. But, yeah, you got to get a little dirty. So I would love to know, well, a couple things. First of all, I'm staring at the current issue, which has a delicious-looking pizza on it.
It does. It's our May issue, and the cover is all about Neapolitan pizza in Naples, which is, that's the special angle. Neapolitan pizza is the bee's knees in New York and in Chicago and in LA and in San Francisco. And in fact, I think the best Neapolitan style pizza I've ever had is in Phoenix, Arizona, of all places. But the Neapolitan pizza on the cover here and the feature story is about actual, real Naples-based Neapolitan pizza. It's written by there's this feature written by Sever senior editor Keith Pandolfi, and he went back, his family is from Naples, and he, you know, visited with Todd Coleman, the creator of our videos, who shot the story, and the two of them went on this trip, and they visited, you know, the buffalo farm where they make the mozzarella, and they visited the mill where all the flour comes from, and spoke to these incredible pizzaiolos for whom pizza is in their blood. You know, they bleed marinara sauce, and the story's gorgeous, and we made pizzas in the test kitchen for, like, a good month, and it was incredible. It's pretty fantastic. Yeah, it'll be on newsstands probably in 3 or 4 days.
You are a very well-traveled gal and cultural gal. Where should I be traveling to if I could be anywhere in the world today?
Anywhere in the world. I travel a lot. No, it's one of the perks of the job. Sever is a food magazine that talks about food through the lens of travel. And to that end, you know, the features in most of our issues span the globe. But one of the areas that Sever's always been really committed to and that I really love and a beat that I've sort of taken up in the last couple of years is exploring all of the food of the United States and the incredible regional diversity. And when I say regional, I don't just mean like the Northeast and the Northwest. Like, this, it's like microclimates, basically. I mean, in some areas of the country, you go from town to town, and it's like you're traveling from country to country. I just got back from a weekend in Charleston, South Carolina, which I know is not news to anybody as an incredible dining destination, but I hadn't been there in a number of years, and I was blown out of the water by what an amazing time I'd had there. I think there's a little bit of a trend among cities of a certain size who are starting to establish a culinary identity to have a degree of what I think of as sort of a hipster homogeneity, where no matter where you are in the country, you're going to have some place that has, like, the homemade burrata and the fresh pesto, and it's delicious, and it's totally wonderful, and the crusty bread and all that stuff. But there isn't too much of a sense of regional identity. Like, you could be in the same kind of hipster locavore restaurant in Illinois as you would be in Massachusetts, as you would be in Colorado. And in Charleston, there is an absolutely ineffable Charleston-ness about absolutely everything. There's an extraordinary sense of heritage and of space and of place and the, you know, bounties of the ocean and the stuff that comes in from the extraordinarily fertile farms around the area and the incredible culinary history of the South in general, but also Charleston very specifically. There's a lot of curry in the food, which is a result, I think, of the spice trade. I mean, there's a sense of history and a sense of place, but it also feels very modern and it feels very fresh. And there's a very sort of youthful and forward-looking component to the food and drink that's happening there. And it was so exciting, so incredibly exciting.
What do you think is a young, emerging U.S. city in the sense of its identity and where it's going with food?
Lately, I've been really, really excited to get out to Kansas City, actually. There are some really cool things happening there. I was just speaking not too long ago with a chef at a restaurant called Port Fonda, which is a Mexican restaurant in Kansas City. And, you know, the stuff that he's doing sounds absolutely amazing. And Kansas City is interesting because it has such a strong history for the beef industry. It's where lots of stockyards were. And I think that, you know, when Kansas City started kind of reinvesting in its culinary identity not too long ago, everything felt very steakhousey. It was, you know, well, we're going to become a great steak city. And there's a crop of young chefs there who grew up in Kansas City and maybe went off to cook in New York or Chicago or San Francisco who've made their way back and have decided to do Kansas City food and the food of the Midwest, of the heartland, and do it in their own way and make it feel very of the moment and very of that place. And that's really exciting.
I also really want to go to Nashville, not only because of the television show, but because of what's happening there and food as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I'm going to Knoxville in a couple of weeks for the Biscuit Festival. Let me tell you, I am going to eat so many biscuits.
Your life is so hard.
It's difficult. It's true.
Helen Rosner, you're the most incredible Helen I've met under the age of 85.
Oh, same to you.
And thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was my great pleasure.
And for more information on what's happening in Sever Magazine, go to sever.com, or you can pick up the print version at your local newsstand. As always, thanks so much to Jack Inslee, Joe Galarraga, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.